Okay, I'm really sorry, but I just realized I hadn't been recording after all. I'm sorry.
Okay, so
let's
two.
Start over.
Take two.
Okay.
Well, you'll be so
Yeah.
nervous. I mean, relax. It's
I
just
know.
me.
I think
I
I
mean,
thought I had pressed the record button,
what's
but
the
I guess
deal?
I hadn't.
Oh, okay.
Okay, sorry, but I do need you to say that. So you understand the. So you've signed the confidentiality papers, and you
I have.
understand the purpose.
Well, I understand the purpose.
Okay. And so, yeah, one more time. Can you tell me where you were born, the year you were born, and like when you moved from Kentucky to, and your name?
She's a real pro here, if anybody's listening. My name is Eugene F. Martin, Eugene Franklin Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N. It's Eugene, E-U-G-E-N-E. I was born in Hazard, Kentucky. February 6, 1951, my family moved from Kentucky to Chattanooga, the Indiana deal, somewhere around that Cincinnati thing. I was only about, probably 5 years old at the time. And we moved to Brainerd, which is a suburb of Chattanooga, Tennessee. That's 37411, is the zip code. My mother still lives in the house, you know, there on Tuxedo Circle, 117 Tuxedo Circle.
So my first question is, do you have any firsthand memories of the American Chestnut, or any experiences, memories of actually being around an actual American Chestnut?
From what I understand, and I've read extensively in this sort of thing, the American Chestnut is supposedly gone. I do personally believe that it's still around, and not all died, you know, due to the fungus that got started, you know, the blight, you know, from the Chinese introduction of the Chinese chestnut, you know, to America. I have personally seen stumps in the National Forest, you know, in the Great Smoky Mountains, that are, you know, still the last remnants of the so-called American chestnut. I have seen many, many old barns and things like this that are made of, you know, the split hand-hewn logs of the actual real American chestnut. When I was a young boy, you know, just a boy, my father, you know, went out to East Brainerd, where supposedly there was some chestnut trees growing, and he and I dug up one. It was on the property of Jim Wilbanks. I can still tell you who that was. I don't believe Jim is still alive. I know my father is deceased. So we brought that tree home, and we planted it in the backyard. And for many, many years, it produced a unique chestnut. I call it an American chestnut. There are individuals that say that it is not, you know, but it's definitely not a Chinese chestnut. This I can because of the size of the nut, the type of bird, the looks of the leaves, the whole nine, nothing about it looks anything like a Chinese chestnut. Whether it's a mutant or something like this, you know, that'd be very hard to say. In the fact that I am 56 years old, this tree was older than I am, you know, at that time. And all through the years that that tree was around, you know, I can tell you that, you know, that there's a big difference in the wood and the trees and this sort of thing. The tree that I currently have, you know, is at 117 Tuxedo Circle. It's in the circle itself. That tree came from a nut that a squirrel would have buried. Otherwise, how could it have gotten under the ground? It was up against the side of the house, and I saw it growing in. Marked it off and waited the following year for it to go dormant, in which time I decided I was going to dig it up, and I personally took it out into the circle and planted it. That tree at this time is probably 35 or 40 years old. I have seen other chestnut trees in the neighborhood, you know, and feel like that they may be, you know, the actual, you know, some other chestnut, some other nut off the same tree. I don't know, but I know personally where there is another one, and I feel like it is. I haven't really gone up and really looked at it that close, but I have, you know, looked at the tree that I planted, and I know that I have given my uncle, his name is Dr. Baker Huff. He lives in Decatur, Georgia, and I have given him for years and years and years 5 gallon buckets, usually 2 buckets per year. And I personally go out and pick up the nuts, the burrs, the chestnuts, you know, and I see to it that Baker gets them, and he's raised them in his basement, you know, gone through all sorts of different ways of trying to plant them and this sort of thing, antifungus and all this kind of stuff. You know, I think there might be some merit to it. He's given those trees away. From my standpoint, I've never had a problem if I wanted to take one of the trees and grow it. I just put it in the ground and up she came. You know, and I've taken those trees and planted them in Lenore City. You know, we had some lake property up there when I was a boy and planted them. I don't know if the individuals that bought that property may have cut them down. I don't know. I've been back in years. But I know, you know, dear, that the tree has always been one of those fanciful things, those things that I've always reminisced on or thought about. The tree means a lot to me. I've done some studying on it. I've seen, you know, the things that in Gatlinburg that the Rangers have put out, you know, in the welcome stations and things, talking about the American chestnut and this sort of thing, the cabins that have been built out of it, and on and on and on. So it's been a romantic thing with me, as I'll say, a mature man now. You know, I'm not in my twilight years, but I'm moving on in time. You know, but
I guess I'm wondering too, how did it get to be that sort of this romantic nostalgic thing? Were there any sort of stories or was some of that nostalgia passed down to you from your parents or anybody like that, or how did you get to
the nostalgia of it all? Was probably my great aunt and my grandmother, who remembered the nuts as a child, in their childhood, and I was fortunate enough to have my great aunt and my grandmother living in the same house that all of us four kids and my mother and father, all of us lived in there in Brainerd, and I could listen to them tell the stories and hear Bing Crosby sing at Christmas, chestnuts roasting on an open fire. I mean, it was just part of our tradition, and we actually had real chestnuts, you know, at that point in time. And then I, of course, you know, the more stories that were told about that and the old pawpaw tree and this and that and the other, you know, from those individuals in my family that were, you know, much, much older than I was, great aunts and that lived to be 90. You know, my mother is now currently probably 83, you know, and I myself am 56. You know, so when you start listening to those memories projected by individuals, it becomes a tradition is not a good word, but just it's sort of like, I don't know, honey, I can watch the Waltons and I start to cry on television. I just don't even watch it. I mean, it's that type of thing. You've got three generations, the young, the middle, your mother and dad, and, you know, here's grandfather and great aunt and aunt and grandmother and everything, all right there. You know, and when you have that, I'll say collection, sometimes I thought a menagerie, of the generations right there to share those memories, either at Christmas or Thanksgiving or sometimes the first cold snap. This cold snap that we're currently having, you know, today and started last night, they would call blackberry winter. It sets the blooms of the blackberry, you know, and we should have a prosperous year and the berries should be sweet. Unless we get a cold snap like this, the blackberries don't set their blooms and it's not as prolific. Those old timers knew that sort of thing. When I was in college, of course, I got my degree, you know, in agriculture, and I did my thesis on the signs. I was so fascinated by foxfire books, Yule Gibbons, you know, taking, you know, he's deceased now, he's an American naturalist and writer, and from Yule Gibbons' standpoint, how to make chestnut flour, make flour out of the nuts. These people actually did this. This is what they used the American chestnut for, is not just to build their homes and barns. You know, they used it to feed the family, to feed livestock and this sort of thing. It was a very crucial and important part of American society. You can look at some of the paintings. I believe it's I'm on the spot. I can't remember. It shows he was a great American artist, you know, and shows a blacksmith shop and children playing. And the name of the actual painting is the American chestnut. You know, the chestnut tree, this sort of thing. And I want to say Rockwell, Norman Rockwell, but I don't believe that was it. But it is a famous, you know, print, you know, that they, you know, you see around, and that the chestnut tree was at one point in time an actual focus, you know, of American life and American culture. I know that because it's reflected, you know, in writings and paintings and things that I'm sure that you've discovered, you know, in your pursuit of knowledge on this particular, you know, variety, you know, of tree. And we say variety in plant world because species, would be an animal. Mm-hmm. So obviously we're dealing botanical here.
So have you yourself ever used the wood or the nuts to eat or build or do anything like that? And if so, how did you learn from any specific person or book or anything how to do that?
I can do craft work and things like that. A good friend of mine is in Boone, North Carolina, and that's Mike and Lucy McGuire. And Mike has his cabinets in his kitchen, you know, made from American chestnut wood. And at one point in time, when we were young men, Mike had what he claimed to be American chestnut, a barn full of stuff, and it may well have been. Mike taught, you know, at Appalachia State University, and he's retired now. But he and Lucy, you know, I went to college at UT Knoxville and knew Lucy from there. And of course, you know, she introduced me to Mike, and Mike and I, you know, have had a friendship all through these years. And I, on occasion, will call them and speak to them. But they actually live in Sugar Grove, you know, which is a little small town outside of Boone. But he taught at Appalachia State, and now he's a master craftsman. He can make anything out of wood or stuff like that. Me, I'm not a master craftsman, but from my standpoint, I have made, you know, some of the limbs. I thought it was rather novel just to, you know, to take it and make candlesticks. You know, just stick a candle in, plain and simple. It's maybe 2 inches in diameter or something, I guess, and a couple inches tall. I thought that's as much as I'm not going to turn bowls and things like that. I didn't have that kind of wood to work with.
Did you, I mean, do you, is there any reason why you would use American American chestnut over some other kind of wood?
Or was it just pretty. When you sand it down, it's real pretty. And it's hard as a rock, as far as it goes. I'm telling you, it'll dull a chainsaw quick. That wood is just, I mean, it's hard wood. Once it dries out and it's cured and that sort of thing. And that's why it was such a good building material. It was almost impervious, you know, to insects and things like that. It didn't warp. It was a great, you know, wood to work. It was a very difficult wood to work with because of it was so tough, you know. But that's why it made cabins and barns, you know, the way that it did it. And they'll stand for decades. You know, because the wood is it's tough wood. I mean, it really is. Yeah. And even with the candlesticks, you start to sand on it, I'm going to tell you, you know, you start sanding, you're going to be sanding a while, because it sands pretty, but it sands tough, I'm going to tell you.
Have you ever eaten the nuts or done anything with the nuts?
No, of course, you know. As with Yule Gibbons, I tried making flour. It wasn't real tasty. I mean, it wasn't real bland, but it didn't have any zing to it. We as children used to take them and we would put them in a little skillet, you know, and roast them the way that you hear the song, you know, chestnuts roasting by the fire. You know, I don't know about roasting by the fire. You want to put them in something, get them to the fire, you know. But you don't want to try to fry them or cook with them or anything like that unless you have either one taken the covering, which is a beautiful color on the nut. You know, you have to take it out. Otherwise, it will explode. It'll have steam in it, and that steam will expand, and it will cause that nut to explode. You don't want that. We made that mistake once. You won't make it again. But yeah, you do have to peel the nut if you're going to cook with it or do whatever you want. But the color in the nut is how to describe it? It looks more of an auburn color. It's absolutely, it's pretty color. It's just a real pretty color, you know.
Let's think. Do you have any sense of sort of what the economic significance of the chestnut, the loss of the chestnut blight would have been?
Absolutely.
Let me know what you know about that.
First of all, from a logging standpoint, those trees that were up there, I believe it was in National Geographic. I saw a little picture of one time of one of the trees before they cut it. The things were bigger than sequoias. They're huge. They were huge, monstrous trees. Huge. You know, I've hiked all up in the back country of the Smoky Mountains, and I'm a trout fisherman. I've told you that. I haven't told you today, but I mean, you know it. But I used to like to backpack and camp and hunt and all that sort of thing. Yeah, I've seen, you know, some of the balsam trees in the Smoky Mountains and places. I'm telling you, deer, they would take 8 grown men to reach around them, you know, and I've seen pictures of the old chestnut trees, you know, where it's got 2 or 3 men standing in front of it, and the things are as big as sequoias. They're huge, absolutely huge.
Do you have any sense of what the economic impact would have been in Chattanooga directly?
Probably not much in Chattanooga. You know, once the blight really came through, they'd already had pine coming in and this sort of thing. The age of the chestnut tree would have been, you know, to the actual pioneers, probably. Mm-hmm. That's where they, one, it fed, you know, their livestock, like the pigs and things like that. You know, so they could put the nuts up, and it was a real starchy nut, you know, mm-hmm. So they would be able to eat the nuts. The wood, they built their homes and cabins with, and barns and things like that. Economically, for something like that, you know, Appalachia, we associate with the South more, you know, Virginia down, you know, the coal mines of Kentucky and things like that. Appalachia, I associate all the way to Pennsylvania and the straight on up. It depends upon which part of, you know, the Appalachia range that you're looking at. And it probably would have been devastating to the, to those individuals who, whose lives revolved around those trees to feed livestock right down basically to their homes and everything that they did. I mean, it's hard for us to visualize an entire continent, you know, with that many probably American, just one type of tree. And it is, well, it is the dominant tree. It's a hard wood. It's, it, it will choke maples out and small pines and things like that. So to have a, you know, I would not suspect that there'd be a lot of diversity amongst the other trees, where if that tree was dominant, it would take up most of the water because of its nut-producing, you know, ability. Mm-hmm. Its leaves are big. Its wood is tough. It's like I say, a great, you know, it would have been a real economic, you know, it would have been a disaster. I mean, you know, families would have depended on them, you know, and I'm sure they did.
So did the chestnut have an economic impact on you directly?
Not me directly. It's been a novel sort of thing. I've bought other books that made mention of it or something like this. So economically, it made somebody else's fortune. It took out of my pocket. But just to get the information. But I, impact-wise on me, it's just left a lasting impression. It's just one of those things that I look back with romance. I look back, you know, even as a writer myself, I look at it and think, you know, nostalgically, you know. So yes, it's played a part in my life, you know. But it's from an actual economic standpoint, no. Everything I've done is, you know, the trees cost me money. I send off nuts, UPS or whatever. I pay for it. I go out and pick up the nuts. I do this, I do that. You know, anything, it's always, but as part of a viable something to me personally, no.
Okay.
You know, this interview is, I'm doing from, just from my heart. I mean, I wouldn't expect anything, you know, but I do find the tree. I've found very few people really know very much about it. You know, but there again, with a degree in agriculture and being a, you know, having landscaped and a degree in floral design, I found that most people would know, you know, an oak tree if it fell on their car. You know, all they know is, oh, a tree fell. You know, I mean, that's about it. You know, you could ask the average person off the street, can you name me five trees? You know, they'll know a pine tree, and they might know an oak. That's about it. You know, depending upon what section of the country you're from, they might know what a maple is, but they wouldn't know what a hickory is.
Why do you think that is?
Just pure ignorance and stupidity. Most people in that I have run into are satisfied with the average status quo. They're not interested in pursuit of knowledge. They're not in the pursuit of nostalgia. They're in their own little world, the way that they perceive it. Mm-hmm. And they are not floral conscious. They are not flower conscious. They are not tree conscious. You know, they are not anything conscious except how does it affect me? Broadening horizons and having a wide diversity of interest and is not your normal Joe Blow off the street. Let's take a good example. He wants to go bass fishing. You know? Well, aren't there any other fish in Lake Chickamauga besides bass? I mean, what do I have to go out here, $25,000 for a boat, motor, and trailer, and all, and another $2,000 or $3,000 worth of equipment, when I can sit on the bank and catch bluegill and crappie? I mean, and probably end up catching a bass or two there too. I mean, what's the big deal? You know, I don't get it. But you know, we're not talking any ichthyology here. We're just talking Not just about a tree.
Oh, well, the other thing we're kind of curious about is how the chestnut or the American chestnut sort of played into the people's sense of identity and place and like community and culture. And a lot of people talk about, you know, that yes, it did help give people a sense of place and like sort of this sense of Appalachia, rural Appalachia. But is there anything specifically that you could point to or can think of that sort of that exemplifies that in any way?
Ask the question again, dear. You lost me.
It's a kind of a strange question. So we're talking about the cultural and community significance of the chestnut.
Okay.
And so were there any cultural use? I guess we're wondering if there's any cultural uses for the chestnut that you can remember.
Culturally, it's played an important economic role in American society. A lot of families survived, due in part, to the chestnut from a home standpoint and a food source. Their livestock depended on it. Go out hunting, wild boar depended on it. Squirrels ate it and things like that. And to believe you me, the squirrels, they'll find it. When I've collected nuts in the fall, you're fighting off the squirrels. I mean, they're going to get to it. I mean, they know, over and above all the acorn trees, there have been walnut trees, there's this, that, and the other tree, that doesn't matter. They head straight for that chestnut first thing. I mean, they're going for it. They'll eat the nuts before they're even ripe. I mean, it's not that they're a lack of food, it's just, it is a preferred food, by the squirrels, and I can tell you that. I've seen it over years of experience. And I've actually shot, I know it's illegal, I was licensed, but you're not supposed to shoot squirrels in the city limit, but with a bow and arrow, it doesn't make any sound, I've actually shot squirrels out of my own tree, and I don't mean it the way it sounds, I'm real country, and I took them in and I cooked them. I'm not bashful. They believe me, a squirrel eats good when you know what you're doing. It's tough, but it's good. Mm-hmm. It's not as tender as rabbit. Rabbit's tender if you cook it right. But squirrel, I don't care how you cook it. It's tough. I mean, it's gonna be tough. Just expect it.
Are there any like songs or sayings or folklore that you can think of that were?
Well, Bing Crosby, I mentioned
right,
earlier.
Sure.
He's dreaming of a white Christmas, but that song goes hand in hand with, chestnuts roasting by the fire. People wonder, what's it, until Kroger started carrying some sort of Chinese chestnut, people look at, what's a chestnut? I bet you could really, ask 50 different people, have you ever had a chestnut? No, I've heard about them, but that's about the comment you're going to get. Mm-hmm. But no, I've seen chestnuts, and I don't know whether they're in an oil or a water base, but they are at the grocery store. You can find them there in a clear jar, but whether they're fit to eat or not, I don't know. I've never bought any of them because if I just wanted some chestnuts, I just either had some in the freezer or what. But like I say, to be perfectly honest, they are... At least I've tried, some of those chestnuts that you can find just in the food store that are on the shelf, not in a jar or anything, just laying there. And I tried some of those. I found they had very little, if any, flavor. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing is true with the chestnuts that we've got, there in the front yard. Very little, if any, real flavor to them.
Yeah.
But now, they must be really high in some sort of starch and sugar. You'd think they'd be sweet if they were, high in sugar. But the squirrels love them. I'll guarantee that. Whoa, you're talking about a war. Because, there'd be two or three of them out there in the same tree at the same time. And they're cracking them, before they'll crack them, before they're they're ready to be eaten. I mean, they're not even ripe yet, and but they must be they're extremely high in starch because they are really pasty tasting. They yes. taste pasty, you know, and it's not one of those things. Oh, it's just roast up some chestnuts and sit by the fire and you know pop those things down. No, man, I'm telling you, it don't work that way. it's not. They are not tasty. I mean, they are not. These are not peanuts and stuff like that, and cashews. You know, those cashews that have no oil, and those cashews that no salt and stuff that you can buy like in the store. I don't know why anybody wants the things. You know, I mean that way, but a lot of people do. I've tried them, and it sort of tastes like that kind of a cashew. It's that texture and it's real dry, not a whole lot of flavor. And that sort of thing, but you know, and everybody likes a cashew, and it does have a if it's got a little oil to it, it does have a little flavor, you know. But realistically, a cashew to me does not have a whole lot of flavor. I mean, and that chestnut, it's the same thing. It just to me, it just doesn't have a lot of flavor. You know what I mean, but I have cooked with it. In Thanksgiving, I've put it in stuffing and things like that, more for a nostalgic thing. I can't really say that it added a whole lot, but there was a crunch to it that it wasn't there if you were just doing your normal turkey, you know, and dressing. But, you know, I've told you I like to cook, and I love to cook. I mean, I really do. You know, it's a real hoot. You know, and so to have some chestnuts like that to cook with is different. I don't, in my age group now, I don't expect a whole lot when I'm cooking, you know, with chestnuts. It's just for me.
Yeah.
You know, I just cause I like it.
Well, I guess the last part of what I wanted to ask is, are you aware of the restoration efforts that are taking place?
I am. You know, I have been for many, many, many years. I've been a part of that, you know, only I've been the silent one. You know, I've been furnishing nuts to my uncle. You know, let him take the glory. I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter to me. I can cut him off next year. You know, my tree keeps producing where he's trying to raise his down there in Atlanta on around Altoona Lake and everywhere else. I'm telling you, he has a good year, a bad year. It didn't produce. It didn't do this. It didn't do that. I'm going, well, I don't understand what the deal is. You know, I have seen some years where it knocked the blooms off, it did this and this. I still got a few nuts. It wasn't what I'd call a bounty, you know, a bountiful year. It wasn't that, you know, by any means. But I still got a few nuts, even after an early frost or this or that. But I have seen it where the nuts are so heavy. You know, that the tree is just laden with them, you know. And when I was a boy, you know, we had one of the trees where I got my tree was from the tree from the backyard. So this I know is second generation. This came from a nut off of that tree, you know. And so that tree is no longer here. But sadly, you know, my father had some whim, he wanted to cut that tree down. You know, I'm going, you know, this is crazy. I don't understand it. And that, I mean, I think that in itself, it just blew me, you know, into I wanted to learn or do or be a part of or whatever. But I used to climb that tree. And the idea was for me to climb up there and shake it real good, you know, and we'd get the nuts come falling to the ground. Well, my great aunt and my dad and this sort of thing, we'd be picking up the nuts. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it, but I soon learned that I'm up in the tree when the nuts are falling and those burrs, mm-hmm. you know, and those are really bad burrs, dear. I mean, they're going to stick you. I mean, they'll tell you, leave me alone, and they mean it, you know. And I'll show you some of those burrs when the season gets, you know. But I'm telling you, get the tree shaking, and all of a sudden those burrs are falling on you in the back and the head and arms and this sort of thing. It took me a while to realize my Aunt Lou and my father moved away from the tree, and there I was. Let's shake this thing. And I'm telling you, it hurts. I mean, it's not just, you know, it's not just that they're heavy with nuts, you know, that they're, you know, they hit you. Man, those burrs, those. When I pick the burrs up I use, you know, leather gloves. I mean, you will, because those things are, once they stick you, I mean, you had it, it's sore for a long time, and it's really, really hard to get it out. But the only way I know to get, you know, some of the little thorns from the burr itself, which surrounds the nut, you know, the casing, and it's real thick. The only way that I know to do, you know, to get those things to swell is to take a slice of potato, you know, and it's raw, and the white part, the meaty part of the potato, take it and put it on there and then tape it up, you know, and something from the starch of the potato actually is absorbed by the thorn, and at least you can see it. You know, you can't hardly see it sometimes. So the thorn swells up, you know, and at that point you can pull it out. And that's the only, that an old timer told me that's the way he did it when he was a boy, on how to get the thorns out of you when you've been out picking, you know, the chestnut. So I've done that.
That's
on
a good story.
Well, I've done it when I'm blackberry picking. I like to go, you know, picking blackberries, and I know where, it's on TVA property, but I know where cherry trees are, real cherries. I mean, yeah, and I don't know if they're maraschino or what they are, but in my years, my great aunt and grandmother taught me how to can, you know, so I like to make jelly and stuff. So, you know, they're nice enough to give me the wild cherries. I'll go, you know, buy the sugar and the pectin and can me up some cherry, you know, like that. That's why I'm fascinated. Yule Gibbons, and you can make flour out of it because it's a real starchy nut, you know, and then mix it with some cornmeal or something like that. And it gives it a different little flavor, you know, as far as cornmeal goes or whatnot. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, the real economic value of if we were still with the American chestnut would be not in the nuts, you know, as such, but in the wood itself. Because, like I say, a tiger tank, you know, is not even going to hardly dent it. I mean, it's just, it's tough. You're talking sandpaper for days, you know, and you wonder if you've even made a dent in it. You know, yeah, it's tough stuff.
Yeah, well, I guess that's my next question. Do you think it's important to restore the tree in the southern Appalachian region?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So why
it's a vital source for wildlife, particularly. If I didn't have firsthand knowledge of fighting the squirrels off, you know, and I mean all sorts of trees now. I'm talking about, I've got beautiful maples, you know, there in the neighborhood. You know, they're gold and they're yellow and they're red. You know, and you know, I've seen, you know, the oak trees. You know, got live oaks. You got red oaks. You got, you know, a lot of nut-bearing trees. I've actually knew of one walnut tree at one point in time. The squirrels wouldn't even touch it. Didn't even want them. You know, I mean, couldn't give them away. You know, I mean, and yet they. You can't beat them out of the tree. You can't. I mean. And the blue jays come up and peck on it, and the birds are very conscious of it, you know. And you can find where the birds have actually, you know, come in, and the tough birds. I mean, we're not talking little songbirds here, the sparrows and cardinals and stuff like that. You know, they're finicky eaters to begin with, you know. But an old, you know, blue jay or a crow or something like that, something with a really large, tough beak, you know. And a big foot to hold that burr. That burr is about this big round, you know. And I've seen them where there's three nuts and one burr. I've seen that, you know. If I take you this year, if you know, and show you here's the harvest time. Here's the time that you don't. You'll see the signs of here's where the birds, you know, squirrels have got to it and that sort of thing. And I mean, if
wildlife, you think
wildlife would flourish. I mean, yeah, they flourish on it.
Yeah,
you know?
You think that's the main.
I would say, yeah, for as far as the actual tree, you know, we got some chestnuts roast by the fire. I'm telling you, if you don't peel them, you know, or cut them a little bit or something, mm-hmm. and we're going to roast those things by the fire, you're going to find out that with it's going to steam up inside. That thing's going to explode. I mean, it is a tight, tight skin on that that goes around the nut. It's not in the burr. The burr's one thing. Then you got the skin that goes around the nut. And if you put that around any heat, that's the moisture inside will expand. And of course, you know, water vapor, you know, would expand 1,800, you know, times its own molecular structure. You know, yeah, it's 1,800 times. So that molecule, one molecule of water is 1,800 times bigger. You can't see steam. You can see water vapor, but you cannot see steam. You know, it's impossible. And so when you think, it's steaming over here, that's a cliche. That is what you're thinking. That's what you're told. You know, what actually burns you, you know, as far as a steam burn goes, you know, you will never see the steam. It's expanded too much. On a molecular structure that you won't see it, but you will feel it. I guarantee.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. But they'll blow, and I mean when they explode, and here we go. There's chestnut flying everywhere, and they'll go. That thing is tight.
So do you think that the restoration efforts are going to be successful, or?
I think they already are. You know, you will find the proponents, you know, that advocate this is not an American chestnut. You know? I don't know. I have always said those same people that are claiming this is not an American chestnut have never seen an American chestnut themselves. You know, I've never seen a real American chestnut. The tree's gone. You know, I mean, as far as the real American chestnut. You know, I mean, you know, come on. You know, so it's not a this, it's not a that. I don't know. I'm just telling you that this is as close to anything that I've ever read about, ever seen, that I have actually seen, you know, where people say this is American chestnut, and it's twice as big as the chestnut, you know, that I'm accustomed to, mm-hmm. or it's big, you know, it's smaller than the Chinese chestnut, or it's this or that or the other. And I'm telling you, these are really small little nuts. It's consistent every single year. I have seen it for over 40 years, you know, that these nuts are consistently the same size, and it produces the same type of tree that it came from, and it produces the same kind of nut that it came from. So there's consistency in what we're dealing with here. This is not some wild thing, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, it reverts right back to a Chinese chestnut the minute you take the nuts off and plant them and grow them, and then it produces. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest problem you have, is what you got today. You know, let's take the nut today. You know, when's it going to produce nuts? You know, it could be maybe 10 years from now, 8 years from now. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're not talking one as old as my tree. You know, and I say it's my tree. It's on city property because I planted it. And I've had some of the city employees that are old timers that come out to do the pruning of the trees and things on public property. Won't touch that tree. I mean, I've been out there. When I was a boy and a young man, I might be out there collecting the nuts, you know, and they'll come by and they won't talk to me about it or this, that, and the other. And I've talked to guys over at UPS, one of them. I was going to, you know, send these things off, you know, and he couldn't believe it, you know, and when I bring him some nuts. So I came back and gave him some nuts. I said, well, here, take some of these, you know. And you know, I thought he was going to have a heart attack, you know, and he'd heard all about the American chestnut, and he'd read all this, that, and the other, and then turn around, all of a sudden, here I am. Oh, look at here. You're him. You know, I'm not Johnny Appleseed, but I'm one of them, you know, and yeah, you know, and then it's through my efforts, and I mean, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. You know, I mean, it's like, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And then I gave him, you know, a bunch of them, and I think he took off from work that day. He's going home. And Baker's got a unique way that he thinks you got to put fungicide on them and this and that and the other thing. And And I don't dig that. You know, that's not the way I'm thinking. And I, with a degree in agriculture, wanting to be a veterinarian, strongly think that there must be something in the saliva. It must be a very acid mouth of a squirrel, and particularly in its little jaws. We call them pouches. You know, where you've seen, you know, and maybe a little squirrel, and his whole face goes like that. I mean, it's out, you know, and he's got, you know, these little nuts all in his mouth. You know, well, his whole face can expand. He can carry little things like that. I personally, and I've never done anything to as far as a study on it, you know, but I know that trees come up in weird places and how they get there. You know, and old blue jay, you know, can carry a nut in its mouth, but that's about the only bird I've ever seen that we see locally. You know, I mean, besides a crow, you know, that would carry a nut somewhere. If he drops it, he just goes back and gets another one. I don't know what's wrong with the one you just dropped. Apparently, they don't like it or something. I don't know. You know, that's a behavior pattern that I haven't studied either. You know, but I've often thought about. But I wonder if sometimes if that saliva that might be in that squirrel's mouth or a little chipmunk that, you know, swells up, his whole face swells up twice his body size. You know. Is there something in their saliva that will act as an antifungal, antibacterial, you know, type agent that on that nut, if they take it and go over here and bury it, thinking I'll come back later, but they don't think I'm coming back later. They just do it, you know. And if there's something like that, you know, in their saliva, you know, I'd like to, maybe in my old age, you know, in the basement of the house or something like this, you know, try to come up with a little study on something like that. But that's a speculative thing. Depending upon pH, bacteria count, or whatever, that would protect that nut if it went over and buried it. Well, I think that's what Baker's trying to do is, you know, what happens in nature? You know, and I'm going, well, wait a minute, you know. You know, soaking them in man-made fungicides and stuff like this and then putting them in the dark of a refrigerator in some sort of a plastic cup. Don't cut it. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but that don't seem natural to me. Now, the nut doesn't know the difference. You know, I mean, that's obvious, dear. You know, I mean, but if I was, you know, if somebody came to me, you know, I'm not going to go out here, you know, my family's dependent on corn supply coming in, and I might want a little shot of some whiskey or something, and I need an antibiotic too, and a, you know, something to put on a cut, you know, or what have you. If I was some old pioneer somewhere, you know, I mean, it'd be different, but my whole life depended on the production of a nut and where they're going. I'm not going to put antifungals type stuff on it and stick it in a plastic bag and or a styrofoam cup and put it in a refrigerator at some temperature, you know? I mean, I know from a floral standpoint, you can fool flowers into thinking, you know, it's obvious. You don't get poinsettias at Christmas time unless it's meant to be, okay? Well, it's meant to be because the market says there will be poinsettias at Christmas and there will be Easter lilies at Easter. You know, there's a reason for that. They're forced, you know. They're going on increasing light. So what you do is you give them decreasing light by just covering the greenhouse and make it dark, you know. And the little plants don't know the difference, and so you get them an increasing daylight, you know, as by taking the covers off of the greenhouse. Yeah. Well, it thinks it's springtime. It don't know November, December. It has no conception of what that is. Well, I'm thoroughly convinced that American Chestnut, the one Baker's, that he does, you know, Baker, they don't know, you know, from Adam's house cat, you know, what the season is, and you're not tricking them by putting them in a cold refrigerator. You know, my idea is you got to freeze them. You know, and if you really want a hardy tree, It takes, you know, you've got to start from the get-go, from the nut. If the nut doesn't know what a hard freeze is this year, what's it going to think next year when it puts up some new growth? It's not going to know. You know, it's not, it survived, it grew because it was conditioned to do so. That's pure and simple. That's the way it works. He's an orthopedic surgeon. I have a degree in agriculture. Bring it on. You know? It's the way it works. You know, I mean, I did my on the signs. Bring it on. You know, but the man won't talk to me, and I am not in any mood to talk to him. You know, not in that regard. But at this point in time, and on today, not in any regard at all. You know, I have no desire to talk to Baker.
Oh,
you know, how you talk to one man thinks he knows it all. He's like most any other, you know, doctor.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to tell him something? Oh, yeah. You know, well, let me tell you what that cow told me. Well, cow, you know, yeah, and that horse over there, you know, they told me a whole lot, you know, more than what you can. You know, you know, good old practical Boy Scout knowledge goes a long ways. You know, I think that's what, in my honest opinion, dear, that's what's wrong with most medical, you know, things today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wimps out there. And, oh, honey, I know it hurts. Let's give you something. You know, hurt. I'll show you what hurt is. You know, I'll put some hurt on you. You know, but no, it's just, you look, you know, I truly believe, and I've seen this in my own experience, I've seen it in other boys and men that I've grown up with. It seems that the tougher we are, you know, is because we went through that little hurt and pain, then we went through this little hurt and pain, then we went through that little hurt and pain. And I know you've asked somebody, well, don't that hurt? Nah, that's all right. They're not immune to pain. They're climatized towards it. Let's put it that way, like a plant would be. It's climatized. It, you know, you don't take an oak tree and put it out in the desert and think it's going to grow. You know, first of all, it's a wrong place, the wrong time. Everything's wrong. It's going to die. Well, I think pain is the same thing. You can condition yourself, you know, to degrees of pain, where somebody is practically in tears. Some other guy nearly cut his finger off. There's not a tear in his eye. I mean, I don't know why is that. You know, I don't know.
Do you think people have sort of like humanized, like chestnut tree in a way? Maybe they're like rooting for it in a way you'd root for.
Those that do, those that know, yeah, you know, they're rooting for it. Yeah, that's like, yeah, a little nostalgic, you know, thing. You know, they're again chestnuts roasting by the fire. I mean. It means more to them than just a song, you know, by some Bing Crosby or something, you know. I mean, it means more to them. You know, they're really fascinated with it. Like, the guy at UPS, I mean, I nearly had a heart attack. You know, I mean, like, look at this. I mean, I had buckets of them, paint buckets, 5-gallon buckets, 3 of them, you know. And I got to have something to put this in and send it down to, you know, Mercedes Drive in Decatur, Georgia. What? I mean, he went wild. I said, well, here, take a couple handfuls. He'll never miss them. You know, and I don't care. I mean, take what you want. You know, I mean, I thought the little man was going to cry. You know, yeah, that's part of it. You do. The ones that know. Those that don't, it's typical. Yeah, and, I mean, your professors in school told you those that do, those that don't, those that can teach. You know, I mean, or I've seen it where they reverse. Those that can't do anything else, you know, you can always teach. You know, I mean, okay. I mean, look what I've got, a knothead for a professor. I mean, you know, I mean, this is going to be a semester course? I can deal with a quarter, but I'd surely not. But thank heavens, you know, it's a three-quarter course and swap teachers off, you know. And thank heaven I don't have to put up with this for a year. You know? So you know, here in your graduate studies, and I'm sure you've thought it's not the course at all, it's who's teaching it.
Yeah. You
know? I mean, it's flattering to a professor to know that they're taking my course because I'm the one teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very flattering to taking the course and they could care less. I mean, they can't wait to get out of here every day. You know?
Yeah, that's the truth. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I've almost gotten through these questions, but so I guess like you were saying earlier that you thought it was important to restore the tree for the wildlife reasons, and that you thought that the measures being taken would be successful.
I think, yeah.
My last question is: do you think that it could ever have a similar economic and cultural role that it did before the blight in the southern Appalachian region? Do you think it'd have a similar role that it had then, today, in the 21st century, or no?
I don't think it'll never have an economic, thing like that. Impact, is the word. That is such a major comeback that we're talking about. We're talking pine groves here. If you've ever been down in southern Georgia and Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, places like that, that's where this accent comes from. But when you've been down to those places, I mean, you're talking somebody with, 200, 500, 1,500, 2,000 acres, and it's an individual, Now, we're not talking about, logging companies. We're not talking about, any of these lumber places where it hadn't got anything to do with that at all. This is that's a major, major scale. That's one thing. Second thing is it's slow growth. We're not talking growth of pine trees here every 8 to 10 years or 12 years. And go through and harvest, and replant another 200-300 acres or 2,000 or whatever it may be. Forestry careers are built, in forestry based on sequoias and southern white pine and this and that and the other thing. The careers are not made, necessarily on black walnut,
So you think the demand for timber is such that it demands that you have these fast-growing trees?
Absolutely. Any forester will tell you that. The nostalgic tree, like the chestnut, would be too slow. The response would be, you're sinking money into it that, there again is a turnaround and we're going to harvest it. And it's such a tough wood, it's going to dull all these machines and everything. I mean, they harvest it by machines. They're not sending some crew in there and they're carrying these, orange steel and McCulloch's and stuff like that, I mean, these chainsaws, steel is one, is ST. Let's see, what is STIHL, I think it is.
Yeah.
And then McCulloch makes another one. I don't know, there's a lot of people make chainsaws, but you're talking about a tree, if we got it up to size, over a generation, I mean, look at me, at my age, the tree I'm talking about, it's probably about as big as this salad bowl you got right here. I mean, this serving bowl. It's not a salad bowl like you'd eat out of. Well, maybe you would. I don't know your table manners, but that's a bowl for at least four, but you might eat out of it. But I think that from, you're not, it's, it'll never make, a commercial comeback, in my opinion. I don't know how. Agriculturally, I can speak because I have a degree in it. You've got to turn some kind of, that corn's got to come on, buddy. And I mean, you can get three crops a year, okay. If you start early in the spring and you don't get an early frost, okay, fine. We get two crops out of it. Well, hopefully if you don't get a, but they're not into that. I mean, get out there and cut that stuff, and make fodder out of it, make whatever they're going to do with it, And I mean, and that's generally what you'll find in the state of Tennessee, one corn crop, that's about it, mm-hmm. One cotton crop, that's about it. I mean, but I do know that our season here in Tennessee is not like the season down in Florida, and southern Georgia and all that. I mean, they can get two and three crops out of things, but we can't, I mean, we have a cold snap, he's lost everything. It didn't come, at all. It came late, so he's late putting in. If he gets one crop out here, he's doing fine. A big, big cash crop in, back when I was younger in the state of Tennessee was tobacco. You know, I mean, that's the way it was. You know, that's, but it's now, you know, that's not the case. You know,
I guess my last question is, do you have any concerns about the restoration efforts or anything that is concerning to you?
No. I don't have any concerns. Concerns would mean to me, you know, dear, if there was something in my hands, you know, to be concerned about. I mean, or in control of. Let me put it that way.
Yes.
You know, don't say yes or to me. I don't. You know, but no, if I'm just one of those old hippies that, you know, if I got some control over something, fine. You know, I can make a change. If I don't have any control over it, it's not up to me to make the decision. It's not for me to direct, you know, the traffic. It's not up to me to do anything. You know, then forget about it. You know, I'm just along for the ride. I'm not going to upset the. Your mom and daddy would say, I'm not going to upset an apple cart over something like that. You know, I mean, if I got some control over it, then fine. Then we can make a decision. But.
What about, so you spoke a little bit about the economic role and how you said you didn't think it could have the same sort of role it had back then, but what about culturally?
Well, culturally, it's yeah. A
cultural symbol.
We've talked about it, you know, yeah. One from artwork, you know, the old blacksmith shop over here underneath the spreading arms of the
yeah.
chestnut tree,
right.
You know. Okay, we've talked about that. We've talked about Yul Gibbons. We've talked
Do you
about,
think it could have those... A similar kind of cultural role today that it did then?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, if some young person, you know, were to able to get a hold of a little chestnut tree and plant it and you know, that's my tree, you know, and there again, it should come with instructions if in the event that we're going to roast these by the fire or put them in a skillet or something, you know, you better open that nut up, because if you don't, you're going to have one bad mistake, you know. That steam's going to expand and, buddy, that thing's going to explode. And I mean, it sounds like a gun going off, you know, but I truly, yes, it could. I don't know that I, in my age or probably in your youth that you've ever had people sitting around talking about the old cashews the way they used to be, you know? I mean, well, big cashew today to me tastes like a cashew I had when I was a boy. I mean, whoopee. And I'm not out here writing, you know, and doing research on a cashew. Now, I'm sure there probably are individuals that do that, you know? But, and like in agriculture, okay, what you gonna do your thesis paper on? You know, I did mine on the science. Other people, you know, here's how to, you know, horseshoe a horse, you know, or here's how to do this or how to do that or what have you. I mean, it just depended, you know, on what you found interesting, you know. On the ag campus, I'll say this for it, when I was at the University of Tennessee, some of the ugliest looking bunch of girls I ever saw in my life were on the ag campus. I can't say that about the main campus, but I don't know. I'm telling you what. I've heard of corn fed before, but boy, they was ugly, you know. But how, whatever they decided they were going to ride about was usually horses and stuff like that, you know. You know. So yeah, but when I was in school, it never really dawned on me to do anything on American chestnut, and I was more interested in the signs, you know, what happens. When's a good time to go fishing? When's a good time to hunt? When's a good time to do this and that and that, you know. And it was in those readings that I did that I was saying, you mean there's something to this? Like an almanac or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you will always, it is nostalgic to think that even today you can pick up an old almanac or this. They still talk about the chestnut tree, you know. They don't talk about the maple. They don't talk about, the, you know, the oak, you know, or this. That. Stand like an oak, you know, hard as head, you know. Yeah, okay, you know. I mean, they don't make oak boards as hard as his head. I mean, you know, they don't dent. You know, I mean, you could crack a rock, you know, with a hammer, but you can hit an old oak board. You know, you might dent it, but it didn't break. And so I've often questioned the fact that his head is hard as a rock. Well, that ain't very hard when you stop to think about it. You know? Well, if he told me his head's like a chestnut plank, boy, that is some hard wood, because it doesn't saw easy. It doesn't mold. What do you want to do with it? You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, it'll dull a saw quick and wear you out. Yeah. But like I say, all I found was just make a little I have some candlesticks of the old tree itself, and I've sanded. And when I tried, I took an auger and was going to drill a hole, you know, for the candle. You know, and it dulled the auger. I mean, that wood is hard as a rock. It was all I could do, put it in a vise, and then, you know, come down, you know, and then I have three pieces that I have made, and they sanded real pretty, but boy, I mean, I wore out an electric sander. I wore it out, mm-hmm. You know, on these three pieces that, you know, where the boys, you know, the guys, you know, my boy, you know, that I used to run around with. We'd go on hiking trips and backpacking trips, stuff like that. Well, I have three pieces of that wood. I wish I had more. It's round, you know, and I sanded it, and then I'd take a picture and put here's a mountain stream, or here's a bunch of us boys, or something like this, you know, and just hanging on the wall, you know. So I have three of them that I can say here's a real piece of wood, you know. But my little tree out in the front, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, but you got to saw a tree down in order to get diameter of, you know, 12, 14 inch wood, right. You know, and what I've seen it in Gatlinburg, I'm telling those trees that they've got on it, you know, the show up there, you know, huge, you know, and they got a poplar tree up there in the Welcome Center, I know, and, you know, I mean, that thing is half as big as a living room. It's huge. You know? Yeah, you need to go to the Welcome Center in Gatlinburg, you know. Always go, you'd be surprised what you see when you're looking for it. Otherwise, Joe Blow just walking through, oh yeah, big stump, you know, and you just keep walking. You know? Mm-hmm. That's not expanding your horizons. When I was in college, they used to tell me, while one sits in dissertation, all the rest sit in relaxation. The process is not called education. You know? The professor didn't really appreciate that too much. You don't see somebody writing down at least what I'm saying, you know, so. That was the old expression that Frank Borger used when I was in chemistry, you know, at UT Chattanooga. He was my freshman chemistry professor and taught me, you know, all through school, you know, other courses. But his favorite expression was, while one sits in dissertation and the rest sit in relaxation, this process is not education. And that's it. He'd get up and walk out of class, and guess what? You know, as he walked out, you know, be a test on Friday, you know, and this is Wednesday, on what? You know, I mean, well, I guess everything, you don't know. And he can go back to the first of the book, you know, but I mean, that's just Frank. Don't make that mistake. You know, you are full attention, you know, when you're listening to Frank. Well, he's deceased now, but I tell you what, he'd make a believer out of it.
Will you tell me that story again about the using a potato to get the burr out of your
hand? Yeah. You know, you just go get.
Story?
It's true. I mean, I still do it today. Even a rose, you know. Remember, I've got a degree in floral design, but even with a rose thorn, you know, I take a potato, just an old white Irish potato that you buy a sack full of them. Down at the grocery store, you get them, what, two pounds, you know, or 5 pounds, or I've seen them 50 pounds. You know, I mean, boy, that's a big bag too. You know, I mean, it's huge. You know, but you'd think it's going to take an ox cart to pick it up. It's heavy, you know. But you know, most people I buy, if I go to the grocery store, I go in and there's two potatoes in a little package or a little loose over here. I mean, I can't use a bag of potatoes. I mean, all at one time. But get a potato, you know, and it works real good with the chestnut burrs because they're real, real small. I mean, this thing's covered in these things. I mean, wow. I mean, thousands, you know, of these things. It's not just like a rose bush, here's a burr, or, you know, here's a thorn, there's a thorn. You can count them. This ain't that kind of thing. I mean, when you get them in there, you got like, you might, boy, you got a bunch. You might have just one, you know, but you can get a bunch. But I used to take Scotch tape and see, you know, if I could get it to stick to the tape, you know, wrap the tape around my finger, you know. That's before you start wearing gloves. You know, wrap your finger with some Scotch tape and pull it back off, you know, and sometimes it would pull the little burrs out, you know. If that didn't work, then the potato trick. You just cut you a slice of potato, just thin slice, you know, and just put it on your finger right there, you know, and then wrap it, you know, in some tape, just old Scotch tape, whatever you got. And forget about it, you know. Wait 45 minutes to an hour. Your skin will turn off white. It'll turn off real soft. Looks like you've been in the bathtub too long. You remember when we were children, you know, and well, I don't know, maybe you do that as an adult now, but I don't. Sit in a bathtub, but I start to, what I call crinkle up. No, I'm bored, let's get out of here. Well, I don't know, I have taken a bath. I wasn't bored. I had a lot of bubbles, you know, I don't recall, but that, when I was younger. I wasn't a kid. You know. I was a young adult, but that's no, we don't go there. But let me get my breath. I just had a thought. Quit this. Good. Quit that now. Okay. Too relaxed here, too relaxed. But no, you just, but it does. It turns off real white, you know, and it causes that burr, that little thorn that's in there. I mean, boy, they're bad, you know. They really hurt, you know. They're real small. You can't see them, you know. And it causes them to swell up, you know. And when they swell up, then you can see them, you know. And then you can just dig them out, or tweezers and needle or whatever you got.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but the potato works.
Who told you that?
One of the old timers, you know, that told me when I was gathering nuts and things like that, you know. And he hadn't, you know. I was giving him some nuts, and he was just driving by, you know. I mean, and then I've had, you know, my great aunt tell me the same thing, you know, and other family relatives and whatnot. But the potato works, you know. But that would have been lost. I mean, what doctor could I go to and tell him, oh, just put some potato on it and wrap it up in some gauze and forget about it, you know? I mean, come back in an hour or two, you know? I mean, oh, yeah. They'd look at me like I'm crazy. You know, yeah, this is really all right. You know, it works. And I'm telling you, it does. But
that's a good story.
But it's just one of those things.
Is there anybody else you think I should talk to? Or is there anybody you can think of who'd be good to talk to, ask some questions to?
In all honesty, probably Baker. You know, I mean, yeah. Baker Huff, Mercedes Drive, Decatur, Georgia. And we can call information and get the number. It's a 404 number, I'm sure.
I think Dr. Craddock might have it or somewhere.
He probably does. But if you, with that information, you can call information and just say he's on Mercedes Drive, Dr. Baker Huff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's in Decatur, Georgia.
Okay.
And I know that information, you know, but if you can't, you can always get it from me. And I've got it up there. I went off and forgot it.
I can get it somewhere.
I've got it. But.
Is there anybody else you can think of? Or?
No. I didn't. You know, the UPS guy, I don't know. I don't. Yeah. I mean, that was such a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know,
all of my. See, Mike and Lucy McGuire? Do you think
that's. Well, you can call Mike, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and Lucy.
What does he teach?
UCI. He doesn't. He's retired now.
What did he teach?
He was at Appalachian State. Crafts, you know, woodworking, all that, you know, art. You know, I mean, he knows how to fire, you know, kilns and pottery and stuff like that there. I mean, he belongs to the Highlander Guild. I mean, that's big time.
I may have met him randomly.
I don't know.
But, look that up.
But Mike is, you know, he's a Highlander Guild. I mean, he's where's the Celt? I mean, he's.
Do you think he'd know much about? He'd have some chestnut stories.
I think he'd have some about the wood, you know, and cabinets in his, you know, in his kitchen and stuff like that. There, you know, it seemed to be a point of interest, you know, to us, you know, when particularly when I saw a barn full of that kind of wood. But I, and to be honest with you, you know, I haven't talked to Mike and Lucy in years and years. It's a long time. The last time Jake, you know, that's their, one of their boys, wanting to, you know, go to school down here at where it's a wood carving school that used to be over in St. Elmo, and they can, you know, make a, you know, a carousel or something. They have the horses on carousels. Whoa. And things. I mean, it's big time. Wow. You know, not very well heard of, but it's big time. Hmm. You know, and whether it's still over there or not, I'd have to go over there and find out and go up a flight of steps and go in, and you could see where they're carving different things. You know, and, but whether Jake didn't pursue it and didn't want to come to Chattanooga, I guess. That's probably the last time I talked to Mike and Lucy. I haven't talked to them in years. But in several years it's been, you know. But that's just,
well, I guess that's it. Yeah. Let me shut this.